Well, thank you all so much for taking the moment to introduce yourselves. Especially in America, when we talk about politics, I think it's sometimes more useful to get a sense of each other's names and that we're all real people to provide a slight buffer against that taking it personally business that Simo very accurately described. Thankfully for me, because talking politics does make me nervous as an American, this will be less about politics. I think this will be more about ways of organizing to solve particular problems. The particular problems that I've used as examples are from my own life and my own involvements, and that for me that comes into union organizing and in anti-racist work. And so that those will be the examples that I'll be talking about. But when we get to hopefully about 11:40, we'll be able to break down and choose whatever topic we like. And so the ideas here, the line of strategies, goals, and tactics are really universal and not particularly aligned with any particular political position. So welcome. You know, I grew up in Kansas partly, and one of my great heroes was John Brown, always considered by most white Americans a madman and a terrorist for doing on behalf of black people what any white person would have done for any white person at the time. But he was a deeply religious man who, you probably all know this story, yeah? He tried to destroy the institution of slavery by attacking and arming enslaved African men, primarily, although women were also part of his planned army, and in fact the groups that he did. And he attacked the unguarded Harper's Ferry arsenal, the armory there. He made some terrible decisions, most of which seem to have been blamable on the fact that the person he considered his general, Harriet Tubman, who was supposed to be with him that day, but who was terribly ill, was not with him. So he made a few desperate mistakes, which ended the thing. Right before he was executed for his role in this, he said he felt that the institution of slavery could not be purged from the United States except by fearful amounts of blood, which was exactly the thing he was trying to avoid by taking over the guns and doing a preventative economic destruction of the institution of slavery. Who knows if he would have been successful. His goals, the problem he faced was the problem of slavery. The goal he had was to end the institution of slavery in the United States. His strategy was to arm a group of anti-slavery advocates, primarily freed African slaves, and to tactically attack slaveholding lands throughout the area, remove the slaves by force, and accept any one of those slaves into his fighting force that would be willing and send the rest on to Canada. He expected that he would have a guerrilla mountain fighting force for years, probably, raiding slave holdings, and that by making it economically unfeasible to be a slave-holding plantation owner, he would be able to destroy the institution of slavery. So those were his problems, his goals, his strategies, and his tactics. And sometimes it's very difficult to separate out what we mean by strategies and tactics, and so I'm just going to do that very briefly. Typically, when we talk about strategies, we mean the general approach to a problem, right? And tactics are the component parts that make up that strategy. Now, it's incredibly important that we have alignment between these things. So if your goal is to keep the dust from rising off of Holden's main gravel road, your strategy, right, might be to wet it down in the mornings. And your tactic would be to get water into the truck that does that, and to do it at a regular morning, right? But if your goal was to keep the dust from rising, and you thought that the best way to do that would be to go up into the tailings at 7 a.m. and do a dance, we might have a misalignment of our goals, our strategies, and our tactics. And misaligning these things is a crucial way in which all sorts of organizing efforts fail. Now, simply having alignment between these things is no guarantee of success. We can argue that John Brown had alignment, I think he probably might have. It's hard to know without the historical events having gone forward. But he failed. I've also got an example of a good, I think, a good source, set of alignments that failed in the Twin Cities in 2005. But without alignment, it is very rare that anyone will be able to succeed in their goals. So the four things that I want to just put out there as themes are the problems we face, the goals we have, the strategies we want to pursue in order to accomplish our goals, and the tactics which make up those strategies. So far, so good? Awesome. The first example I want to give, the problems, it's not just enough to say slavery is a problem, right? In order to come up with a strategy to accomplish our goals of eradicating slavery, it is important for us to understand the interests of the institution or sometimes the actual people who we see as promoting this problem, so slaveholders, right? We won't be able to create an effective strategy to fight slavery unless we understand why the slaveholders are holding slaves, right? So without that understanding, there's no possibility of a genuinely productive strategy. So it's important that we understand our enemy, whether that enemy is an actual human being or more often, a system or a structure, a set of institutions. Okay. So the first example of misalignment that I would like to offer to you was a strike I was involved in at the University of Minnesota in 2007. As I said, most of my work has been in union organizing and anti-racist work. So those are the examples I have to offer. In 2007, the clerical workers at the University of Minnesota went on strike. The reasons for the strike were typical reasons for strikes. There were going to be cut wages, layoffs, reduction of benefits, rejiggering of contribution to healthcare plans, and a substantial reduction of autonomy and promotion. AFSCME, which is the large clerical union for the state and city groups, went on strike, and their leadership chose Everyone knows what a picket is. You've seen pickets, people with the signs, right? What they chose, there's many different types of pickets. What they chose to do was what we call a promotional picket. And a promotional picket is when you stand on the side of roads with signs that say, honk if you love unions, right? And people go by and they honk and they feel good and they move on and very little else changes. So it feels good to get that public affirmation. It feels good to do those things. But it's hard to understand how that would force the University of Minnesota to acquiesce to the demands. There were a number of us. I'm a member of a union called the Industrial Workers of the World, and we had a number of members who were members of both AFSCME and the IWW. And so as what we call dual carters, we came out in support of our membership, who were also members of the AFSCME group. In caucuses with the AFSCME leadership, we promoted a direct action technique, basically blockades of deliveries, right? And these are all legal strike strategies, although people don't like them very much, except workers because they win. But so we took over a loading dock, and we managed to stop, in the course of about 1 hour, over 15 trucks of deliveries to the main cafeteria building, which also houses a lot of university structure. That caused a lot of damage to the institution. It hurt them in a way that we can imagine might actually have provoked them to acquiescing to their demands, had we been able to go long enough. Instead, I was going to say one of our membership, but I'll just fess up and say that it was myself, was attacked on the line, and the result of that was that the picket fell apart. My neck was broken in three places, and I ended up having to be taken to the hospital. One of the things that's unusual about these picket lines, well, it's not unusual, but it's unusual if you've never been on one, is that the minute something like that happens on a picket line, the police show up and immediately attack the union picketers. So we had all sorts of issues. So that's an example of conflicting forms of alignment, promotional pickets versus direct action pickets. One of them is easy to ignore by the employers, right? And one of them is very hard to ignore and can provoke much more hostile responses So you have to know what you're getting into. It's not enough to know, you know, good strategies, you know, good tactics. These will be effective. Sometimes you have to be aware that you're putting yourself in danger, because people will protect their interests, regardless of whether you think those interests are good or bad ones. So that's an example of what I think of as conflicting alignments, and I use that example before moving on to examples of alignment and failure. In 2005, in the Twin Cities, Northwest Airlines declared that it was worried about bankruptcy. Northwest Airlines, as many of you know, had its hub in the Twin Cities before it did go bankrupt. And AMFA, which is the American Mechanics or Airline Mechanics Fraternal Association, were the people who kept the engines running, kept the landing gear greased so that it would actually come down at landing, kept the flaps moving on your airplanes, so the people who made things safe. Northwest Airlines declared that they were going to unilaterally abrogate the labor contract they had with AMFA as a result of the impending bankruptcy. As you can imagine, this ticked off the mechanics a great deal. They went out on strike. And meanwhile, the people that Northwest Airlines was hiring to replace the skilled long-term airline mechanics were, by and large, lawnmower engine repair people. They didn't let the public know this, and luckily there were no major incidents, but there were a few very close calls that came out later. So Northwest Airlines management was willing to endanger the public in order to break the back of their airline mechanics who were organized. The AMFA folks, in coordination with the IWW again, in fact you'll see a bunch of us in there in the video I'm about to show you, came out and directly tried to replace replacement workers, who we call scabs, from entering the workplace. Now this is a form of alignment of strategy and tactic, right? We're trying to keep Northwest Airlines from functioning without our labor. It's our labor that should keep Northwest Airlines functioning. It's we who are the mechanics, not these lawnmower guys. You know, nice as they may be in the outside world, they're taking our jobs and they're doing it for less. And even if we might think, well, everybody needs work, these people were going to be fired about a month afterwards, right? They were very temporary. They were not going to have jobs in the future. So they were very, very temporary. So what I'd like to do is show you a couple of short Fox News, actually, clips. I sure hope that comes back on. There we go. We'll talk about that. This is a 5-minute clip, and there's two short news pieces here.
This is Fox 9 News with Robin Robinson, Jeff Bessel, meteorologist Jamie Peterson, and sports with Jeff Grayson.
Northwest Airlines is admitting tonight that it's running out of time to avoid bankruptcy. Carriers blaming spike in fuel prices.
Meanwhile, a top-secret plan by Northwest Airlines mechanics turned into an explosive situation. The striking workers attempted to keep their replacements from work. Michelle McGinnis is live in Bloomington with that story. Michelle.
I can tell you, union members met in this parking lot at strike headquarters earlier today. It was here that they boarded 3 buses. Now, most of the workers had no idea where they were heading. They were simply told it would be the biggest thing they've done yet. With Labor Day just around the corner.
This is our weekend. This is Labor Day weekend.
Union members say they're taking it to a new level. Part picket.
You guys are standing on the front lines of the labor movement. You're making history right now.
Part rally. Right. What will you do if police tell you that you have to move? We'll see when we get there. Part barricade.
Today they're not going to go to work. That's all it is. Today there's no scabs going to work.
Union members converged on 3 Twin Cities hotels housing replacement workers. It was a plan so secretive, only union leadership knew where the members were heading. The idea to catch Northwest off guard and prevent the workers from getting to work.
I'm going to stand in front of this bus. I'm not going to let this bus leave until the police tells me I can't stay here.
Wherever bus loads of replacement workers went, union members were waiting.
Your parents know what you're doing.
Fox 9 cameras caught this face-to-face confrontation between union members and a replacement worker.
You're taking my job, man! No, man! If you guys get out of the work! What do you think about your options out, man?
That's my state, that's city.
Eventually, police did break it up, telling union members they'd have to let the empty bus go, but it wouldn't go far.
What was the deal with the flat tire on the first bus?
I have no idea about any of that.
But through the chanting, the finger pointing, and the gesturing, a bus did load in one hotel's back parking lot, and police made it clear this time the bus would not be stopped. Does that mean this was a failure for you?
No, absolutely not. We kept one bus from leaving. We disrupted their chain of events.
Now, union members handed out these flyers today asking replacement workers to stop crossing the picket line. There's even a number on the bottom here where they're telling replacement workers they can call for gas money or a bus ticket home. Didn't see a lot of takers on this today, but the replacement worker that you saw in our video, he said he will be changing one thing, and that's his hotel. Reporting live in Bloomington, Michelle McGinnis, Fox 9 News.
All right, thanks, Michelle.
Just a few days later.
Labor unions come to the aid of Northwest Mechanics. 2 weeks ago, they blocked buses of replacement workers.
And tonight, they used their cars to plug up Airport Lane. That's the main road where replacement workers enter and exit the maintenance facility. Michelle McGinnis was there, joins us now with more. Michelle?
Well, you know, it started as a rally and ended with at least two people in handcuffs.
Today's union rally.
We do have power. And the more of us that act together, the more power we have.
Drew a crowd of hundreds.
If the managers, vice presidents, and CEO of Northwest Airlines did half as good a job running that airline as the AMFA Local 33 mechanics do keeping the planes in the air, then that airline wouldn't be bankrupt today.
But it's what happened after the rally.
Please join the car caravan to go greet the pickers.
That was supposed to send a message of just how bad they can be. The music across the freeway was a symphony of horns.
Don't you love a parade?
I didn't know anything about this. So that was my normal strike duty right here today, and then when it happened, it was a surprise.
The car caravan stretching blocks and blocks plugged up Airport Lane right at shift change.
It's beautiful. Gotta stand for what's right.
We're not gonna lay down and just roll over.
But it wouldn't be long before this guy found himself sitting in the back of a squad car, one and then another, arrested for impeding traffic.
We gotta go, so grab our stuff. As soon as we can get out, let's go.
Airport police closed the gates. Replacement workers were taken in the other side of the airport, and everyone over here was ordered to clear out.
Hi, they ruined our parade.
Still, feeling a strong message was sent.
And it just shows us and everyone else, we still get a lot of support out there.
Now, even those who had permission to picket there had to leave. One union member told me they could lose their permit to picket there. Reporting live in Bloomington, Rochelle McGinnis, Fox 9 News.
So a couple of things I want to point out about those things. That's what I would consider a good example of alignment. But there's something they refused to consider before engaging in this. Anybody think about what that might be? Well, they negotiations had already failed. Unions, actually, in the United States, if they have contracts, usually are forbidden from going out on strike until negotiations have.
Now, when you say failed, you mean one group decided not to talk to the other group?
Basically, that nobody was going to budge from their bargaining positions to a place where they can find a compromise.
Well, it seems like they didn't consider the legality of what they were doing. Later, the police are going to.
All of what they were doing was legal.
Well, it's not illegal to impede traffic. I would say they wouldn't have moved.
That's right.
Right?
I mean, right.
You can get away with it for a while.
That's right.
But at some point, somebody's going to get arrested.
And so part of what they forgot to consider was the police.
Yeah.
That in both of those clips, the police were the folks who made the strategy that they had adopted untenable. And this is one of the situations in which police oftentimes find themselves in opposition to social movements. Good or ill.
In the first clip, it looked like there was somebody in a pilot's uniform with the pickets.
Yep.
Did they have the support of the pilot's union and the Lightning's union?
This is the greatest failure of contemporary business trade unions. I always use Northwest Airlines 2005 as the example of the difference between trade union organizing and industrial organizing. Trade union organizing is organizing along a craft. So all the engineers stay together, the plumbers stay together, the electricians stay together, and they go out on strike in support of each other. Industrial organizing is when everybody who works at a single employer site is in the same union. So the mechanics, the flight attendants, the pilots would have all been in the same union in an industrial strategy. As it is, instead, with craft union organizing, most of the time, the different craft unions at a single employee site will scab on each other, and they won't stand out in solidarity. You did see a flight attendant, and I don't know if there were any pilots out there. You may have seen somebody, I didn't. But some of them individually came out in support. But the lack of sufficient mobilization and the lack of ability to predict sufficiently what the police response was going to be led to the failure of the 2005 strike. Everybody in AMFA was fired. AMFA was closed down. And Northwest Airlines managed to save a few bucks for a couple of years before they finally devolved into bankruptcy and sold their operation to Delta.
I wonder if they failed to account for the general public's support also in that.
Yeah.
You know, if I was stuck in that line and I was flying another airline, yep, I'd be kind of ticked off that I missed my flight. I was taking Delta or whatever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's hard to find public support for labor unions in the United States. Union membership is at about an all-time low. It's about 8% right now nationwide. And so there's all sorts of considerations as to, you know, how much the broader public even knows about unions and how they work and why they don't operate on a consumer model instead of a production model. Mm-hmm. So while it's important to mobilize public support, that's not usually where unions try and focus their energies. Sure.
In the first clip, when they were at the hotel, I don't understand why the gentleman was yelling at the temporary worker, the scab, because I feel like that's a misplaced energy in the fact that they were trying to target Northwest, but in fact they were targeting the temporary workers as to not allow them to go to work. But I felt like Northwest could have gathered those temporary workers from anywhere, so why are you targeting them and not the organization?
I think the way they put it at the time was that there was no way to target the organization without targeting the means by which they were trying to continue their operation. And those means were the scabs. And so while there's nothing personal against the individual replacement workers, they were their engagement with Northwest Airlines was going to destroy the jobs of the AMFA workers and was going to prevent them from ever even having a possibility of regaining their jobs. So union work is oftentimes very conflictual. It is an agonistic environment. It's not the sort of thing where you can just all get along. There are interests which people will defend, and they are oftentimes, if not always, opposed to the interests of the group that's trying to organize. And, you know, it's why the American labor movement has adopted the song Solidarity Forever as its anthem. And the idea of solidarity is that, you know, people shouldn't scab on each other's work. They shouldn't steal each other's jobs. They shouldn't steal each other's livelihood. And that's what would be required to have a sufficient mobilization to make an aligned strategy like this work. But it's not always pleasant.
So I was there watching, right? I mean, 70 yeah. miles away, watching. Yeah. It was obvious to me watching it, they were going to fail.
Yeah.
Right? AMFA had no chance of winning.
Yep.
Right? I mean, the company was going broke.
Yeah.
You can argue that the people in charge that were doing the wrong things, but
sure.
they had the support of the board and
yeah.
everything like that, and so they were headed down a path that was going to fail. Why they didn't try something that had at least some chance of success, you know, I could never understand that. And it was as though their leadership, you know, just believed they could bully their way through it or something like that, and it
yeah.
didn't work. So
what alternative strategy would you have?
Negotiation. They had to reduce the cost, right?
Yeah. Well,
right. I mean, every airline has reduced the cost over years. Every industry has reduced the cost over years. It was inevitably going to happen. Why didn't they try something there?
I think union members would hardly disagree with you about the inevitability of that. And even if they didn't disagree with you about the inevitability, of that, they would argue that it's not in their interests to accept it. The negotiations had, as I said, failed. Northwest was basically giving an ultimatum. They said, we're going to get rid of you one way or the other. We're just going to abrogate your contract. So there was no,
sure.
Yeah, there was no negotiation that was really possible in that setting. But, you know, there's certainly other strategies that they could have taken on. But negotiating downward would have simply meant, well, what do you want to give me? And I'll take that.
But that's what ended up.
No, yeah, they lost everything.
Right.
They lost everything. It was a complete failure.
Right. So, and sitting off to the side, you could see that coming, right?
I think some people could and other people couldn't. But
well,
yeah,
it was very similar to the Hormel situation a few years earlier than that, right?
It was obvious
that, you know, they were going to fail. Right?
Yeah.
They did, and they failed spectacularly.
Yeah.
Right?
And it took a long time and a lot of effort.
Yeah.
Was there any effort to publicize the inadequacy of the skill and training of the replacement?
There was an effort, but but the local papers refused to cover it.
Why?
Well, the local reporter for the Star Tribune, who had been on the labor beat, was a guy named Randy First. And he had been taken off of the labor beat and put on basically social detail as a result of his aggressive coverage of the P9 strike, the Hormel strike that was referred to. And so the employers of the Star Tribune didn't want him covering labor issues. And so they basically had a largely a blackout sort of situation. They covered it in the most sort of cursory way.
Local TV station?
This was about as much news as there was over the strike. I mean,
surely there were alternative media that would have been sympathetic to making the point that Northwest Airlines was endangering its passengers.
Yeah.
You simply to get rid of the union. I mean, that's...
You would think.
Didn't the real failures, though, start? I mean, whether it was Hormel or the airline workers or whether it was the
air traffic controllers
in 1948 with the Taft-Hartley Act. I mean, that was basically passed by a Republican Congress over a presidential veto, and it's been a long...
It's been...
Actually, it was kind of a slow slide starting out from about 1970, mid-70s. It's been a cataclysmic slide after that.
It's been horrible. I mean, watching organized labor, if you value organized labor, watching its decline in the last half century has been absolutely catastrophic and a source of despair.
In the United States.
In the United States, although in much of the world as well.
It's taken a little longer for some of the
rest. Yeah, and there's a resurgence of it right now, which is interesting. But yeah, it's been horrible. It's very hard to win anything, and so the inevitability of it, as you pointed out, is something that is simultaneously a context of despair. But the inevitability is not, for most workers, sort of a reason to give up. If it is inevitable, you still have to struggle for what you need.
I'm not quite clear whether Taft-Hartley or unions themselves are primarily responsible for the I forgot how you described it, the craft organizing, which has been much easier to attack than abroad.
I largely blame union leadership. The business unions have largely turned themselves into HR organizations, where they manage labor on behalf of the employers. It largely, unions have betrayed their own membership by and large. Taft-Hartley was devastating as a law, but there were ways to legally sort of obviate its positions, but those would have gutted the privileges and salaries of some extremely well-paid union bureaucrats at the top.
Did the air traffic controller strike, did that sort of set an, it was a huge precedent, wasn't it?
It was a huge precedent. The PATCO strike in 1984 was a huge precedent. And the fact that Ronald Reagan stepped in with his executive authority and simply, said, nope, you're all done.
You're fired.
Right. I mean, it sent shockwaves through public sector unions, which we can still feel today in Madison, right, and beyond.
Yeah.
Now, the union that I belong to is an education.
Yeah.
State public laws prevailing. We had a system of mediation. And mediation failed due to entire arbitration. In our particular case, arbitration could and probably would end up in last best offer. Now, obviously, this doesn't apply to a private industry. But it seems to me a strategy that is sensible. You know, if you look at last best offer, you eliminate the extreme positions, which is a form of compromise. And in a situation like you're describing, compromise is not, you know, contemplated. You just don't compromise.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of peer pressure, both from the leaders of the union and the other side, to say no, no, no. We're just not going to yield. Sometimes I think it's a peer pressure more than anything else that wins out in the long run. But generally, if you're looking for a strategy to deal with a situation like that, it seems to me that even in the private world, you could handle it through mediation, arbitration, and last best offer. Or maybe not last best offer, but at least arbitration.
Well, I would suggest that while that may be true in many cases, what that excludes from consideration is the vastly different bargaining position of employer and employee. The employers have a lot more resources and can wait out a lot longer than the employer can. So if the employers are offering 10 and the workers are demanding 20, and the workers need 12 to survive, right? And the employer is never going to go above 10, you know, compromising at 11 is still not sufficient. At some point, compromise breaks down. And it's always good to start with compromise where it can be reached. The situations where strikes usually happen, and I have very little fondness for union leadership, by and large, and I've seen some of the bullying tactics that you're referring to. But, you know, I think there's also the issue of, you know, compromises. Sometimes you can compromise yourself into a situation which is absolutely untenable. And that happens because you don't start from the same bargaining position. Somebody has a lot more power than the other.
You can do it. So how could they have been better aligned?
I'm not sure they could have been.
It seems like, why would pilots fly a plane that they might not be safe because of the workers?
It's a great question. I wish I knew. And had they stuck with the mechanics and succeeded somehow here, would the pilots be paid a living wage at this point? Some of you may know that where being an airline pilot used to be a very good job,
yeah,
a high-paying job. Nowadays, most private airline pilots are in various forms of state welfare.
Yeah, regional airlines.
Yeah.
The main reason was that there were federal inspectors who were checking, okay? And the public was reassured that those folks would not let a plane take off that wasn't, you know, safe. And so the belief was that it was, you know, the system was working, okay? They got, you know, somebody who's not trained properly or, you know, hasn't had a lot of experience, but they're still going to protect us, so. And I think the pilots probably felt somewhat the same way.
They probably believed it, yeah.
Yeah, and they do their own safety inspections, and if they didn't think it was safe, they wouldn't have flown it either, so.
Is it not the case that now much of the maintenance is being outsourced to Asian countries? Mm-hmm. And so it's outside the control of federal inspectors, and so if that is true, is it not actually?
It's not outside the control, no.
Of federal inspectors. If maintenance is being carried out in any one of a number of different Asian countries, I think it has.
A lot of refurbishment now is being done in Latin America
for
U.S. airlines, yes.
Well, that alone, I mean, the safety issues are obvious, I mean.
Eric, I was wondering about the cultural issue of collective organizing versus a culture of individualism. And when I was looking at that encounter between the union worker and the scab and thinking, okay, maybe his frame is, hey man, I need a job.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking after me.
That's definitely.
And the union guy's thinking, system, there's a system of organizing and providing for jobs, and you're going counter to that, to the ethic of thinking collectively, which impacts me individually. But I just think, is there a way, if that's a real issue, is there a way organizers think strategically about how to engage collective action in a culture that's really focused on individualism?
There are people who have tried various ways of doing that. The only one that I personally have found to be effective or inspiring to me is attempting to enroll more and more people into various forms of collective action, oftentimes in a slow and progressive way, and get them to see what they can accomplish when they cooperate with others rather than trying to go it alone. But the culture of individualism in the United States is a profound obstacle to collective organizing. It's a profound obstacle.
It's a profound obstacle to the church being the church.
Yeah.
I mean, I almost would say individualism is heretical from a theological perspective, because I no longer am myself, but I'm a member of the body of Christ. I mean, our whole baptismal theology puts us into a collective body of which we're one member, which seems like it would align really well with that kind of framework of collective organizing. But individualism has so sort of warped how we even think about Christian identity and community that it's hard to...
We're in a building called Koinonia.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? We're in a building that Holden Village is named Koinonia after community. A community which presumably values its members and wants to take care of them and serve them just as it requires them to serve each other,
yeah.
Right? It seems to me that it's a very religious value to emphasize community. John Steinbeck often was quoted as saying that the reason Americans didn't work together to better their situation is that in America there are no members of the working class. They're only temporarily embarrassed millionaires. And the strategy of, rather, the orientation of individual pull yourself up by the bootstraps sort of progress has really sort of become one of the dominant narratives, the only narratives of success in the United States. By the way, if you've never considered it, everyone know what a bootstrap actually is? It's those two little eyelets at the top of your boots. Imagine yourself standing in boots, pulling on those eyelets and trying to pull yourself off the ground. It doesn't work, right? You can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps. At the best, you can pull your boots on. And so it's a very cruel metaphor just to begin with.
And politically, the individualism is huge as to, I've got a job which has health care. You don't. That's too bad. But I'm not really going to be interested in some form of cooperative health service or... I mean, you just see it in all kinds of... I'm an American, and you're living outside the border, and that's where you'll stay,
Or, and the divisions happen everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. I'm an American, and you're not.
And you're not.
Or I'm an American with a job, and you don't have one, and that's probably because you're a bad person.
You haven't worked hard enough.
Maybe you're a drunk.
Mm-hmm. Lazy.
Maybe you're lazy, mm-hmm. Right? I always get questions when I do union organizing where people say, well, what about the lazy workers, mm-hmm. Right? Well, there will always be lazy workers, okay? That's just me. Has anybody ever met a lazy person?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But now I'm going to ask you a different question. Who's the lazy worker in here? Please raise your hand. Okay? So guess what? I'm willing to work a little bit harder to take care of you three, but, I'm not willing to live in a situation where you three, simply by being somewhat lazy, don't deserve to eat, have housing, health care, or clothing. Go ahead, be lazy, please. Right? The rest of us might be able to do a little bit of extra work to cover you. And, as with my children, maybe a good example and a tiny bit of shame might get you to buck up.
And we see that in Europe now where whole nations are economically failing and they're looking to, who's gonna help us out here? Well, maybe Germany, maybe...
Especially the pigs, right? Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. they are all about to fail,
mm-hmm.
Right? The austerity programs that are coming down in those countries have created massive citizen revolts, which are not politically coherent at the moment, right? They are formed of a lot of different types of people with a lot of different types of strategies, a lot of different analyses of the problems, What they all share is that they hate what's happening. Mm-hmm. In Spain, unemployment is above 25%. And it's even much worse than that for people who are younger. Okay? And austerity being demanded by the central bank in Germany, the Eurozone, is really crushing any ability for Spain to effectively rule itself. The representational system is losing its credibility in Spain as a consequence of the control by the Eurozone of Spain's economic system. Right, so people are losing the ability to trust the representational government. It's a recipe for disaster. I'll be talking a little bit about Spain tomorrow.
You know, it's very, forgive me for it, it's really impossible to argue from the various European examples, you know, over to the US, because the cultural and the economic, social background is so different.
Yeah.
And people's attitudes are so different. People might consider not wishing to look at European models just because, you know, so many economies over there are going under. But that's not really relevant as far as our circumstances here in the US are concerned, I think. I just wanted to ask you one question, I'm sorry. You know, if it's really true, it is, you know, I mean, certainly thought to be this way in Europe, that American unions have basically taken the role of being HR people on behalf of, you know, large employers in the US. What was it that prevented them from acting at the HR level and taking care thereby of lazy workers and so forth, and at the same time, when it became important to do so, to become also effective bargainers at the bargaining table, you know, for increasing wages?
Sure.
Why were the two fundamentally incompatible? That's what I don't understand.
Why is it incompatible to be both HR managers and effective?
Right, because I mean, it is said, for example, that since the 1970s, since 78, the average wage, you know, appropriately scaled, of course, you know,
sure,
until the present time, has not changed at all in this country.
Right.
So there's been no improvement in earning power on the part of the average American worker from 78 to 2011. Absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
How
especially if
how
you compare to the productivity increase.
No, that, well, precisely. And people have, you know, there are many commentaries on that, as I'm sure you know better than I do. But nevertheless, it is fantastic,
yeah,
that, you know, this is the result of American union functioning or lack of functioning. It's absolutely. Could you just tell me what's going on behind the scenes, since you are a union organizer? Because it's inexcusable as far as I'm concerned.
It is inexcusable. I should explain that the union to which I belong is a very radical union which forbids union leadership from being paid or from holding office for more than 1 year. All union leadership is immediately recallable. And we are rank and file dominated by direct democracy. And as a result, the widespread view within the IWW is that what happened is that you start getting folks like, well, the old guy was John Sweeney, nowadays it's Richard Trumka, right? Well, does he look, does he dress like he's a member of the working class anymore? No, the man's making hundreds of thousands of dollars in salary. The man is indebted and hangs out with the employers more than the employees. When you start acting, when you start being paid directly by the employer, your loyalties go to them. So one of the most important things that happened in union organizing and to cause its dissolution is what we call dues checkoff. Dues checkoff is when workers do not pay their union dues to the union membership, to the union leaders, but instead pay their dues. Their dues are taken out of their paycheck. And so the people who are paying the union leadership are actually the employers. The union leadership gets their paycheck from the people against whom they are supposed to be effectively organizing. Right? And so there's a serious conflict of interest that happens there.
And again, I'm sorry to be naive, but the reason why workers, if you want to call them that, in this country, tolerated this was what exactly? Or did they just simply not understand what was going on?
Oh my God, if I knew that, I wouldn't even be here. I'd be out doing something with that. I wish I knew.
But it is extraordinary.
It is.
Yeah.
Well,
there's
something called the post-war consensus, which is that after World War II, when the unions kind of, I mean, there was a split in the unions in 48, 49, where they kicked out the left unions and adopted this business union model. But because there wasn't really worldwide competition, demands by the business unions for higher wages could just be passed along. Those higher wages could be passed along with higher prices because there's no competition for washing machines and cars and things like that made by Americans. So you know, workers didn't really have to be activists, didn't have to do anything because their union leaders were able to deliver pay raises Now, the downside was is that they, the union leaders and unions, stopped negotiating shop floor organization of work and things like that. So, for instance, the Longshore Workers Union, which is a very strong militant union, were taken a bit by surprise when the docks became automated, and their union membership got decimated. But they did fight that a little too late. So then in the 70s, where we hit the peak of wages, that's when the world finally starts competing with the United States. And so these demands for increased wages can't be passed along by increased prices. But the union had forgotten how to fight by then. And most of the laws, the Taft-Hartley and things like that, that built on that, had prohibited most of those tactics also, the secondary strikes, which would be like the pilots striking in support of the mechanics. So, when Reagan fired those air traffic controllers, basically sets open season on unions. Unions didn't really have the knowledge anymore or the infrastructure ability to fight back. And so it's been concession after concession after concession.
But the absolutely the underlying reason was that productivity all the time in some way was increasing as a result of automation, computer control, and so forth, so that supervisory personnel, in the event of a wildcat strike, for example, would take over and keep the plant running without any major problem. Would that be basically the underlying reason for this? In a manner which, by the way, did not apply to other countries in the world, to the best of my knowledge. And that's what's so remarkable about it.
Well, that's true in a few industries, but... Yeah, I mean,
I don't think that's a major.
You do not think so?
No.
Some commentators, actually have indicated they believe that to be the case. For example, Richard Wolff wrote recently a monograph on this thing. But I'm an outsider. I'm not actually an economist at all, so I don't know.
Yeah, I'm asking. What I've been reading recently is economists are kind of taking out the technology factor because it's been around long enough to look at and compare it to other periods of time when technology innovation was huge. Even the turn of the century was probably the hugest. And that was a more equitable distribution of wealth during that period of time. Workers did actually gain increases in salary due to increases in productivity. As the whole increased, everybody's votes did rise. That's not been true. One of the factors we have talked about is actually during the same period of time, the early 70s, late 70s, the rise of corporate lobbying occurred.
Sure.
And that has been a mega growth business. And if you look at the legislation and the implications of legislation, most of the productivity has gone to the top in that.
When you say most of the productivity is on the top?
Well, in the creation of institutions, basically, it's not been tax policy or technology or anything. It's actually been in how we created institutions in this country. And no expert on this. I'm trying to think of an example. During the 50s and 60s, you saw the rise of consumerism. Corporate America became panic at the rise because there was a common interest between consumers and workers during that period of time. And Nader initiatives and things like that were very worrisome. Some of the most successful didn't pass, but consumer protection bureaus, EPA, all those came under public administrations. That stopped in the break, basically, period of the 70s and 80s. The Chamber of Commerce went from a $100,000 a year budget to billions of dollars a year budget in that period of time. So the effect that they've had institutionally on our country in terms of tax policies, write-offs, what companies have control or regulators have actually become so interlinked with industry that you could have a machinist strike and the regulators would say, well, looks good to me. You know, oh, that's right, the supervisor is telling me what I need to check off on the plane to make sure it's safe.
Well, yeah, I mean, forgive me for talking about this at all, I'm really sorry.
No, I think you're...
Yeah, but I shouldn't be just jabbering, I understand this, and I apologize for doing this, but this gentleman is leading, he can't tolerate. the thing is this, you know, in the 1970s, I gather that the US was the most egalitarian of the developed nations, you know, in terms of income distribution. Now it is the least. In other words, we have the largest gap between the very poor and the very rich. But in the 1970s, it was the smallest. It's absolutely amazing, actually, what has happened. And yet, you can go to almost any well-established news organization and not read about this at all. Mm. It's a remarkable achievement, I have to say. I mean, if this is actually a capitalist conspiracy, I'm very interested.
That's what surprised me, why unions don't address that.
Yeah. Yeah. Or why some youth organizations, I mean, they used to have, I gather, this is before my time, but an IF Stone Weekly or Bi-Weekly or something many centuries ago, that some kind of magazine, you know, would somehow appear that would begin to provide a commentary on this that wouldn't necessarily be socialist, but just simply straightforward commentary on what's really going on in the country without attaching labels to it. And why has that not happened? It's absolutely amazing to me it has not. I'm sorry?
It's apathy.
Well, apathy, yes, but I mean, then yeah. suddenly you're bankrupt, you know,
right.
and you lose your house, et cetera, et cetera. And then apathy, it's too late.
Mm. Growing up in Germany, I just the culture is so different here. I was at first really shocked because we grow up, and in high school, there's huge demonstrations all the time. They're peaceful, they're, you know, people just... Thousands and thousands of them go, and people join in, and it's just a normal thing that's okay. And the teachers would let us go, you know, we would skip a couple of classes, go, it's part of becoming a citizen, you right. know. It's almost expected that you do that. And it doesn't have this label of, you know, you're liberal, and it's just, I think, really important that, especially as young people, that you find out where you stand and what you're doing. And, so, I mean, I when I first moved here, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was no matter what was going on, nobody would complain. Mm. Or if they did, then just amongst each other, just like at work, you know, the Republicans talk amongst each other and complain, and the Democrats talk about amongst each other and complain, but they don't talk, like what you said, with each other and try, you know, some kind
of... And the vast majority of Americans sit at home and watch about 5 hours of television a night.
Yeah, and so I was so excited last year when this whole 99% thing started. I was like, they're waking up. And then, nothing. And I'm just kind of wondering, we had 4 years of Obama. Has that helped the unions at all? Has he encouraged the unions?
I wish I could say yes. In many ways, Obama has been far more reactionary and opposed to unions than even his predecessor.
So it seems like the Occupy movement really had a problem with the line, like you talk about. You know, there was a lot of sympathetic people at first, and we kept waiting for them to, you know, issue some. Yeah. Okay. What is it now? You know, what are we out to achieve? And it just kind of disintegrated into a mess.
Probably because there's no history of how to do it, how to strategy.
If I may say this, because alternative models, you know, for describing the situation are just simply not taught in schools. I mean, Americans, forgive me for saying so, have no idea about, you know, the range of political opinion in the world at all. They don't know about it.
Well, it's distressing.
It's a staggering situation.
When even Alan Greenspan, who I think can reliably be called the last high priest of capitalism, you know, goes in front of the United States legislature and admits that the model that he has followed as a religion his entire life, and I say religion quite seriously, is flawed, and that he misunderstood it, and that it is incorrect, right? When you get simultaneously Fidel Castro saying communism doesn't work, and Greenspan saying capitalism is a flawed model inside the same year, right? And yet American schools are incapable of teaching the history of either, right? We have a serious problem with, however you want to think about it, the preparation of citizens, the development of a broad and cosmopolitan view of the world in which multiple perspectives can be entertained and selected. It's a crisis.
And the state legislature in Texas wants to remove critical thinking from the curriculum.
That's
schools.
Right. Critical thinking is a danger to God. Critical thinking is a danger to God in the months.
Unions came about because there were real problems, right?
Very real problems.
And they were affecting a large number of people, whether it's the safety and jobs and that sort of thing. So it's kind of a relevance question, right? And I think there's an awful lot of people, a high percentage of people, let's put it that way, that really don't believe unions are relevant to any problem that we have today, right?
That's right.
Whether it's because of individualism or whatever it may be, it is, they don't seem to be solving the problem, right? The teachers' unions, because you're protecting some lazy teachers and you're preventing, the education system from moving forward, right? You're irrelevant to the problems that we have, or you're in opposition to the problems that we have. And I don't see it changing until something happens there, where there's some realignment of the goals to the problems of the country as a whole. I just don't see how that's going to...
May I return to my John Brown metaphor and extend what you're saying?
Sure.
Which is that John Brown, as I said at the beginning, wanted to prevent mass bloodshed. The mass bloodshed that he thought was the only alternative to his method for ending slavery.
Yeah. Mass bloodshed.
And we had ended up with the Civil War because he failed. If we can make an analogy, I think that we are entering a period where we need to come up with an organizing strategy that will actually accomplish our goals before a much larger crisis and cataclysm comes down upon us. It is more important to fix the problems as soon as we can than to let them exacerbate themselves. We are out of time. I was going to show you a clip and tell you some of the history of pushing the neo-Nazis, the National Socialist Movement, and the Supreme White Alliance out of the Twin Cities. We have some video of a community mobilization against the first attempt by the National Socialist Movement to reestablish a bulkhead in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region after we kicked them out about 15 years previously. Hmm. It was a long and sometimes bloody, frankly, battle to kick them out the first time. They came back to the YWCA, which was offering white privilege and anti-racism training, under the assumption that the white race is in danger and being discriminated against. Hmm. They held their demo in the heart of the Latino neighborhood in the Twin Cities. Members who had been involved in the struggle to kick the National Socialist Movement and Bound for Glory, which was a famous neo-Nazi band in the 80s and 90s, out of St. Paul, reorganized, remobilized their contacts and got a lot of community members. We had over 200 people show up and directly confront them. And they didn't show up again in the Twin Cities. They did show up in Duluth this March. And we did the same thing with much more struggle. People in Minneapolis and the Twin Cities seemed to be much more comfortable with direct, loud confrontation. There were a very dominant pacifist and movement in Duluth which was opposed to giving them any attention. There's an idea that floats around that fascists are somehow rebellious teenagers who will go away if they're just ignored. When you actually see fascists in public, they tend not to be teenagers. They tend to be older men and a bunch of meth heads who hang around them. I will just, since we're out of time, I won't show you the video, but I will say that if you are of that ilk who believe that they can be ignored, I'll just point out that the same people we were protesting in the video that I was going to show you were arrested 2 months ago for an attempt to hunt down members of leftist organizations in the Twin Cities, including myself, and had a plan to bomb the Mexican consulate office in the Twin Cities. They're currently being held and on trial. Fascist groups remain alive, and public mobilization, organization, and doing it in a way that aligns our understanding of the problems we face, the goals we have, and our strategies and tactics is important in accomplishing our goals. If our goals are to defend neighborhoods from violent attack, and somebody had been attacked and nearly murdered about two nights previously and had a swastika carved into them. So we believe that that was part of the thing. But you know, these are real threats, and they're real threats to people who may not look like us. I'm a white man, so they aren't after me until they realize I'm a race traitor, and that I'm not interested in preserving white privilege over other people. At that point, they get very angry at me. But the people who are in most danger are immigrants right now, gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender people. And it's a challenge. And whatever challenge you face in your life, organizing to align your strategies, your tactics, so that you accomplish your goal. And you need to do this with an understanding of what drives the situation which you're trying to change. Is crucial in having any success at all. There's no guarantee of success, but the option is not to try. So, thank you so much for what was a wonderful conversation.